You're listening to the 21st Century Change Agent Show. This podcast is for those who are always looking for ways to grow as a person and as a leader. On this show, you'll find no ordinary conversations, as I will be speaking with unique people who are already rewriting the narrative. My name is Barbara Ziga, and I help companies to achieve more by putting their people first. Head to Lake House Consulting website to find out more and subscribe to a bite-sized, hand-picked newsletter from me. Thank you for tuning in and get ready to receive your weekly dose of inspiration. Hello, hello, and thank you so much for joining me for episode number 11, where we will be redefining fatherhood. Fatherhood is facing an interesting time right now. On one hand, there still is this historical model of a father as a man who works with his hands, who will build a dollhouse for his daughter with a screwdriver in his right hand and a cold beer in his left. On the other hand, fathers have been tasked more than ever to define where they stand on feminism, on gender roles, and on politics. So what is the mode of a modern dad? What is the blueprint that men should be following and modeling now? And ultimately, how much has the role of fathers truly advanced over the past half century? Traditional family structures have shifted over the past several decades as fathers engage in more child caregiving. Yet fatherhood inclusive practice and perspective remains limited. Policies and programs perpetuate stereotypes of fathers' role, namely that of the financial provider. Fathers also face increased social cultural pressure to be involved in caregiving and equally receive pushback from workplaces for trying to do so, such as through taking paternity leave. Reimagining fatherhood narrative will require shedding fatherhood stigmas and adopting what is true today. Fathers are capable, they are eager to share parental duties and are more engaged than ever. To talk about this and how we reimagine fatherhood, I invited Michael Ray to share the stage with me to shed some light on these topics. Michael is an author, speaker, and a fatherhood advocate. Michael's story is very moving and yet not too uncommon. I'll let you hear from him. Here is my conversation with Michael. Right, well, hello, Michael. I'll say good morning to some of the listeners, but I'll say good evening to you because we've got a good 9-hour difference as we are recording this. And thank you so much for agreeing to come on this show. And thank you for jumping on this call to talk about reimagining fatherhood.
You're welcome, baby. I really appreciate the opportunity.
In terms of today's agenda, obviously, I'm very, very keen to learn more about how this term of fatherhood has evolved. Where are we today? And actually, where are we headed if we take pandemic into account as well? So before we jump into the nitty-gritty of the actual conversation, I would really want to hear from yourself. And how did you come to being a real advocate for these topics? Just hear a little bit more about your journey.
Baby, I wasn't always this woke advocate for equality bloke. I came from a typical or stereotypical heteronormative family where dad was the breadwinner and mum ran the home. I grew up in a really hyper-masculine and worked in hyper-masculine fields where I worked doing personal security for a lot of rock stars and a nightclub doorman, so pretty blokey bloke. And then I ended up being an elite level strength and conditioning coach, so again around pretty hyper masculine men and women as well, so elite level women, boxers as well, and all sorts of sports. Got to the age of 49 and I thought fatherhood had passed me by, living the life of excess, and suddenly after a short-term relationship I ended up a dad at 49 years of age, and the world came to my world as I knew it came to a shuddering halt. And suddenly the ego and the facade and the pretense that I'd been living up until then, it all seemed a little bit of a void had been left. My preparation for parenthood as far as being raised in my family was to the extent of, my mum saying to me, wait until you have kids, then you'll realise. There was no practical instruction. There was no preparation, and I honestly thought it passed me by. Charlie was 9 months old when her mum and I separated, and at the same time I actually was diagnosed after a small car accident. I was diagnosed with a life-threatening condition. They found some lumps and bumps that weren't meant to be there after just a routine scan, and suddenly the only thing that I could think of then, it wasn't the life that I built or the possessions that I'd gathered or acquired, it was how was my demise going to affect my daughter. And so it was like my house had become a burning house and flames were leaping through the roof, and suddenly in that moment of crisis I was forced to consider what was I prepared to run back in and try and save. And the only thing I could think of was my time with my daughter and how my lack of concern for my health, because I'd been sick for a while up until that point, would impact her. And I've lived my life like that since, and it's been just Charlie and I for since she was 2 years old now. Her mum's played no part in her life since then, so it was very eye-opening, to say the least. The thing that really stood out suddenly was my self-doubt, because I'd grown up in a world where, motherhood is fetishized with all of those images of, mother knows best, only a mother's love, maternal instinct, and all of those things that dad, it undermines our confidence, and it makes us delegate or defer most parenting decisions to mum, because we have that misguided perception that mum has some sort of secret source or some innate instinct that just simply knows how to parent and nurture children better than men. But the problem with that is it adds so much pressure onto mothers who may be struggling with the normal, frustrations of raising a toddler, whether it be colic or breastfeeding or perinatal or postnatal depression and all of those things. It can lead women to doubt themselves, not only as a mum, but as a woman, because they have this pressure put upon them that they're just meant to know, that it's meant to come naturally. And it's not. It's a learned trait. It's a learned skill. You have to develop it and be committed. And no different for a man or a woman. If a couple brings home their baby for the first time, it still has that perception, well, give the child to mum. Mum will be able to settle it. But, my mother raised three kids. Two of them turned out great. Me, not so good, people would argue. But my mum couldn't settle my daughter as good as what I could, because I had that time in role. So I knew what worked, and I developed it over the course of time with experience. So rather than mother knows best, it should be practice makes progress. And regardless whether you're man, woman, or non-binary, you need to just relax. It's not as hard as what people say, in my opinion.
When you talked about how you became a father at age of 49, and then your mother at that point didn't give you much advice anymore, you just had to run with it. It's also and we'll unpack that topic in a little bit more detail, but it is actually you do have parents talking to females in a very different, or their girls in a very different way, and groom them into being mothers all their lives. But we don't necessarily do the same thing for our sons and for our boys. And I think that, again, and when you do reach your adulthood, be it 30 or 40, by default, in society and organization, a man and a father often has got very different role to play. And by default, again, therefore, there are different levels of expectations. So even though, both mother and father are parents, we've got very different expectations from a mother and a father.
Oh,
And that's, again, you know, old stigmatized practices that still are very much alive.
100%, baby. There's still a stigma for single mums, and yet myself as a solo dad, I'm praised just for doing the most basic of things. You know, if I can manage to keep my daughter fed, safe, and secure, oh, you know, you must be a wonderful man. What a great dad. But on the opposite side, mums are, it's nearly a contest to see who can mother more intensely. And, you know, if, you know, the thing I get all the time is, oh, how could a mother leave her child? And it's, well, no, how could a parent leave a child? And women are stigmatized should they want to focus their career or, you know, have a life outside of motherhood. They're judged a lot more harshly, and not by men. I would dare to say that a lot of women are some of the women's harshest critics.
100%. I totally agree with you, because often when women say, you know, I am a single mother, not a lot of people question it, why it is. It's just sort of, you know, it just happens. You know, men are men. They go, they find, you know, other women, or God forbid, maybe something has happened to them. But when mothers do that, then yeah, absolutely, they are completely excluded by the society, and they've lost their role as not only a mother, but also a woman. They're sort of this, in this no man's land. You know, they can't be accepted by society if they can afford to turn their backs on their children. So I would totally agree with you that there, again, are very different punishments or very different views on, you know, on mothers and fathers, and how mothers and fathers should be praised and how mothers and fathers should be penalized for what they do and what they don't do.
It's funny. It seems in our contemporary society, parenting is the last bastion that we haven't tried to remove the gender bias and lens from. You know, mothering is, you know, to mother is a verb instead of just a noun. You know, we don't use parenting. You know, when I get praised for being a great father, I try and correct, and I say, no, I want to be a great parent, because there's a lot lower bar for a dad. A great dad is judged on a whole different set of KPIs and outcomes to a mum.
Absolutely. And another thing to that is that when you're a solo parent, when you're a solo dad or a single mother, you are both roles in the same. So, you know, yes, of course, you're female, and hence, you know, you are a mother, but ultimately you're a parent, because you, on some days you have to be the dad and on some days you have to be the mother. So you are totally wearing both of the hats.
Definitely. And I think, depending on which echo chamber, the problem we have nowadays is with the confirmational bias that happens with the algorithms on social media, and especially when you're a single or solo parent, sometimes you're a little bit more isolated, so you get a lot of your contact and context through social media. So depending on which group you interact with, you're fed more stuff that confirms, you know, your outlook and your experience. And I think it's done a great disservice to the equality movement, where it seems to almost have become like a football match with genders to be barracked for and against. And I think that's one of the things that's holding us all back. We all need, because I'm in a unique position where I get to sit in on conversations, participate as a peer and as an observer in both groups, in groups of men who speak freely and openly around me, and with groups of women, because I'm considered, you know, one of the girls in a lot of groups. And I hear, and while women want to have more of a life outside of just their children, you know, the number of women that I've met that have stepped out of their career because it just simply wasn't able to combine with their parenting duties, with such incredible talent, experience, qualifications, degrees, and they've just, you know what, it was too hard with work, I was stressed and all the rest of it, but because dad didn't have the option of working part-time, because the majority of our quality initiatives have actually been aimed at women, flexible work for women, men are twice as likely to be rejected for a flexible working thing. So, of course, it all falls back on to mum. And Dr. Laura Ratcliffe has done some incredible research and written some papers on this, and it shows that the more flexibility or family-friendly practices that mum has, the more caring she ends up doing as well. So what's happened with a lot of the workplace initiatives and programs, they've actually reinforced the outdated gender expectations. They come from a position of, well, we've got to find a way for mum to be able to participate in the workforce outside of the home while still maintaining her caring duties in home, because there hasn't been a concurrent focus on getting dads out of the workplace. And when I speak to dads, they want more time with their kids. Mums want more time in the workforce. And yet somehow, and that's why I say, if we drew a Venn diagram, we would overlap so much. But, you know, it just seems the constant finger pointing and criticism. You know, some of it might come from the divorce courts, where there's a conflation of negative, you know, outcomes for divorce courts. But, you know, we still have our child support system here that basically says one parent should care for the child and one parent should work to support it. And it's such an outdated, counterproductive thing. So and it doesn't matter what amount of child support you're paying, it doesn't make up for the amount of money you lose on career stress, all the associated incomes. You pay a percentage of your income to the caring parent, but you know it can't make up for the impact that it will have on their opportunities and careers going forward.
I absolutely agree with everything you've said, and I think there's just so much to unpack there, from stereotypes in society and institution and language we use. And I would just love to unpack those one by one with you today. So there is obviously a lot of discussion going on right now about what a fatherhood and a manhood really look like today in 2021. There is a lot of talk about, you know, this, the modern father, you know, that this is a figure who knows how to express emotions, he knows that being home and being present are not the same thing. What a father looks like is obviously majorly influenced and shaped by personal experiences and culture. And you know, you shared, you know, a story of your own, which is, again, you know, not unique. And as father's role, and father's role is unscripted and unique. However, as a solo dad, you know, to a young daughter and someone whose bread and butter are these subjects, what are the trends that you're seeing now? And are you seeing the narrative changing in the world of fatherhood? And what does it actually mean to be a dad today?
Oh, 100%, it's changing, baby. There's never been a better time to be a father than now, but in the future, it will still be even better once it's destigmatized. Here in Australia, one in five single parent households are now fathers. So while it's statistically uncommon, the problem we have is it's seen as unusual. So it's even seen as unusual by men and as women. And I still have a lot of friends that say, you know, when are you going to go back to, you know, training athletes and things like that? And I'd say, well, no, I think that's past me, because I've never felt more fulfilled and I've never enjoyed my day-to-day so much as being fully involved and present with my daughter. Whereas, you know, having to train and travel with football teams and weekends away and things like that, luckily my situation and circumstances herded me into this fulfilling role as a father. The other thing that we have is a lot of the language around fatherhood has changed now. So a good dad used to be someone who would go out and earn well and bring home money and provide for his parents and for his children. And that's what I say to dads when I speak to them. You are a disciplinarian, and to discipline means to teach. So you're the example. You teach children new values. You're the role model for how they should be treated, how they should respond to life's challenges. You do provide, you are a provider. You provide them with nurturing, comfort, a safe port, connection. You know, so we just need to reframe it. you are brave. You're brave enough to admit you're vulnerable, because as a dad, it's very easy to appear like a superhero. I know my dad was my hero, and it wasn't until I lost a brother in a car accident that suddenly my dad became human. He wasn't this, you know, stoic figure, and, you know, it really enriched our relationship. So, you know, we've got to be there to let our kids know, you know, you're going to doubt yourself. You're going to be nervous. You're going to have fears, but that's normal. And, you know, I got my daughter to watch Space Odyssey 2001 when Hal takes over. And we've got this innate fear of artificial intelligence or self-drive cars because we just, oh, you know, I still want to be in control. And that's why I say to her, hell is basically your thoughts. They're driving you somewhere where you mightn't want to go. So you've got to take the time to stop and go, is this thought real? Do I want to go where this thought is driving me? Am I in the passenger seat or the driver's seat of this life? Have I given over to this artificial intelligence, to my thoughts? So examine that. So that's why I say to dads, you've got to be brave, and brave enough to admit, as I said, you're vulnerable, you're scared, brave enough to go to the doctors, which I didn't go, you know, courageous enough to admit that you don't know it all. And, you know, the biggest example you can give to your kids as a dad is that you're fallible. So you make a mistake, you laugh it off, you get up and you go again. And, you know, don't worry about being judged, because as men, we try desperately. We want to follow rules and standards of behavior that allow us to belong. And a lot of times we're following rules and standards to try and belong to a group who are trying to follow rules and standards to belong to another group, and no one's actually being themselves. And when I actually speak to dads in groups, the emotion and the honesty and the vulnerability that comes out once they realize it's a safe space, I've seen some of the biggest, toughest, hardest men break down in tears and all hug each other. And, you know, we're all so similar, but we're all hiding behind that facade of what society expects from us rather than what we want.
And speaking of sort of those stereotypes, and you already alluded on that, there's obviously a lot of stereotypes and that need to be addressed. You know, as you already mentioned, for example, the dad is a financial provider or breadwinner. And according to research, this is the most dominant stereotype across diverse racial and ethnic groups. And this, as many other narratives about fatherhood, are a product of society that are portraying fathers as uninterested in parenting. And companies are perpetuating this with policies that do not support fathers to be at home supporting their partners, you know, during the first months of pregnancy or creating a bond with the baby. And of course, you know, historical gender and cultural stereotypes, society has play a huge role in this. But however, you know, workplaces are often no better. We often find gender-neutral policies, but not necessarily gender-neutral practices. And when we see more men wanting to play an active role in parenting, it is the equality outside our homes that is lacking. And that's where the dynamics do not add up. And, you know, what are your views in this? And have you seen much progress recently in both society and workplaces?
The problem I see when I speak to organisations about their low uptake of parental leave for dads is the culture. If you put a program in place and it's not being utilised, you've got to look at the culture, if it's available. So, you know, we jump on, rightly, we jump on any sexual harassment, any improper, you know, inter-office relationships, all of those things can bring an organisation down. But as the brilliant John Adams says, we still have a culture that has that will, you know, ridicule a man for man flu, and we have men in Australia suiciding at the rate of 7 per day and over 60,000 attempts per year, but we want to diminish his illness with, you know, the taunt of, oh, it's man flu, he's just being dramatic, and all of those things play into it. But a lot of organizations go to the trouble of installing a shared parental leave thing, and it's low at 2 or 3%, and that's because fathers perceive that there will be a penalty on the career should they take up on it, because we have other men in the organization bragging about working 80 hours a week and I crushed this, and you know, I'm here at 5 and I'm here 5 in the morning and I'm leaving at 7 at night and all of that. The organization, the HR department, needs to actively and you know, vigorously stamp that out and put in family-friendly policies, because if you're redlining, or if you're thrashing your team constantly, if they're, you know, a stretch project every now and again is good, but you need to, you know, acknowledge it, maybe even put some family-friendly time in, support the families. But one of the most divisive and misguided things that we did was somehow classify breadwinning as separate from caregiving. It's allowed workplaces to be willfully blind to our parental responsibilities. And if you look at the outcomes for the 20% of children who live in poverty, breadwinning could well be one of the most vital parts of caregiving. But for some reason, and again, I think it's because of that conflation between the divorce or separation things, well, you're the breadwinner, I'm the caregiver, the children come with me. I think it's been used, what was meant to be a shield has sort of been used as a sword. So, you know, no good being an organisation that puts in a shared parental leave and encourages dad to, you know, you go off for a couple of months, but dads aren't just for, just as puppies and kittens aren't just for Christmas, dads aren't just for shared parental leave. So again, you need to put in policies going forward that will enable, you know, flexibility for dads as much as mums, because the minute dads don't have it, mums have to pick it up. And I think that's what has been holding back the equality thing. Too many organisations keen to support mums in their fervour to be family friendly without realising, well, we actually need to encourage dads, because when dad steps out of the workforce or job shares or anything like that, opportunities rise up for women to take those roles. So that's the biggest thing. Most organisations have to go, right, tick that box, shared parental leave, men aren't interested. And you need to ask, why aren't they interested?
That's right. And obviously, you know, we've talked about society and we've talked about organisation, but there's also the institution as government. You know, governments are also not doing enough. They're not campaigning enough. They're not talking enough about the positive impact of parenthood. We do a lot for smoking, for instance, and the health impacts of that, but we don't talk about, you know, parenting and also health, some mental health impacts of that as well. And I think, you know, the government should be pushing the boundaries a little bit more, you know, making it more interesting, more engaging. And but the government is so risk averse and they are afraid of receiving any opinions that might be coming in from, you know, any of the sides. But these are core issues. These are political issues also from, you know, policy and society point of view, but they treat it as a very transactional thing. So obviously we've got, so you talked about obviously a justice system, you know, when it comes to separation and who takes caregiving and who does financial support. So it's a very transactional, very bipolar thing. One does one does the other. But when do we come together and start blending these up and start actually treating it as a societal thing that is fundamental for the whole sort of system that institution is? And now I think more than ever, when topics as mental well-being and mental health have hit mainstream more than ever.
Yep, yeah, definitely, baby. The biggest problem we have is the divisive nature of some of the advocacy that goes on, some of the shouty, screamy type advocates that want to rail against the other side. I get a lot of requests to speak at what's called men's rights associations, and they are one of the most toxic, hateful, you know, just frightening groups that I won't be a part of, because, you know, they're responding to the rhetoric that they cop as well. But, you know, that's why I'd say with your values can't be transactional or conditional. They're, you either believe in equality or you don't. So the problem we have with government policies here in Australia, the shared parental leave or dad leave, sorry, the paid partner's leave is 2 weeks at minimum pay, which is $714 Australian dollars before tax, which at the moment we're about 72 cents in the US dollar. So, you know, that would be about $500 US per week. So if I'm a dad and I'm, you know, earning the average wage, which is nearly 2.5 times that, and I'm told, right, well, you can take 2 weeks off at that minimum pay, suddenly it's portrayed as dads aren't interested in, you know, because not many men take up the full gamut, the full portion of that 2 weeks. And it's got nothing to do with gender. It's a financial decision made for the benefit of the family. But in that instant, the tone and trajectory is set for the parental involvement. So dad comes home from work, pass me the baby, you know, let me help you. Well, straight away, you've relegated yourself to the role of assistant. You know, I'm going to help mum with it. I get home and give her a break. And, you know, then it gets hard because kids change that much. What works 1 week doesn't work the next, and they just change. So suddenly dad can't settle. What do I do? He defers to mum because suddenly it's become mum's wheelhouse. And it just goes on for that. So dad says, right, what can I do to be the best dad? Well, I'm going to go out and make sure mum has everything she needs, you know, that, you know, we're financially secure and we can have holidays and that, you know, bubs can go off to private school. So I'm going to work even harder, and it further entrenches it. And the division between mum's role and dad's role just gets wider and wider as time goes on. And then kids start deferring to mum as well. You know, mum, what do I do here? What do I do there? And then dads misguidedly think that letting mum run everything. So again, you know, what would you like for dinner? Well, you know, whatever you think, you know, it just adds to the mental load of mum again. And it sort of diminishes the importance of what she's doing. And that's why I say when I speak to organisations, I can't believe you guys here in the C-suite. You want to be involved in every report, every meeting, every part of the minutiae of the running of any project. But when you get home and you're asked, what would you like for dinner? Oh, I don't care. You know, but, and it's just, you know, and straight away, you know, you think you're being helpful and thoughtful. Well, you know, you're not. And the reason that management is the highest paid position in organizations is because of the decision making and the direction that you're taking the company. And yet at home, you know, you don't want to be in that management. You're happy to be the assistant, and you're not really the assistant. You're just a drone that, you know, tell me what to do and I'll do it. I'm a great husband. I'm helping you. Well, you know, it's actually having the opposite effect.
100%. And it was quite interesting, you know, your reflections of the father rights institution in Australia, that wants you part of them, and also around the, and obviously them being the one of the most toxic institutions that you've seen, and also around the government paying dads minimum wage, even though they might be on, you know, three times the salary. That's very literally penalizing the parent, yeah, or dad in this instance, for wanting to be a father. So absolutely, you know, institutions and government is not on family side, and they are not, and they probably, and those policies probably haven't been changed for, you know, past 100 years, and no, and it's in, it seems in no one's interest to go back and, you know, having a look at this, actually, how has our society changed? And then obviously in the hens, there is a huge pressure on the private sector, on the, you know, organizations to lead by example. And once we run fast enough and far enough, maybe the government will catch up then, saying, actually, yes, there is a bit of a gap here that we need to bridge. But they won't meet us where we are. They will sort of, you know, tiptoe behind us and do the bare minimum. And that's the most concerning thing, because these are the institutions that should be representing and supporting us first and foremost.
Yeah, that's the thing with governments. They never really set the agenda. They catch up and they follow it because they want to placate us rather than lead us or be bold. I noticed France has just doubled the paternal leave to 1 month, and they've actually, there's 1 week mandatory for dads, which is just brilliant. And, you know, that's the sort of stuff we need, because so much of what ails us as a society has its beginning in childhood. You know, that insecure attachment. You know, we've got at the moment stressed, anxious parents raising stressed, anxious kids, and it's just going to, you know, exacerbate and increase all the way along. But we also have, you know, it starts from such an early age. We have early learning educators who still segregate boys and girls. They have a boys' corner and a girls' corner. We do it as parents. We, you know, with little boys, it's, oh, he's going to break hearts, and gee, you're going to have to lock her up in a convent until she's 30. And, you know, just stupid things. And if a little boy and a little girl are friends, it's, oh, he's your little boyfriend. So straight away we're teaching our kids you can't have a platonic relationship with somebody of the opposite sex. And there are just so many things that feed into it. But our marketing, my daughter at 8 years old noticed one day in the supermarket, she just said, "Dad, why aren't there any boys on any of the packets?" And I said, "Oh, geez, I didn't realize." So we went out, we got a piece of paper, came back in with a camera, and we photographed. There were 28 products that had a person on the front, and out of those 28 products, only three had men on them. Everything from dishwashing liquid to laundry powder to baby products to cake mixes. And so what my daughter was being told at 8 years old, if it's domestic duties, it's a woman's domain. And, you know, the products and the companies that women are supporting by purchasing these aren't really supporting women that much. Even, you know, I was banned from being backstage at my daughter's four-year-old ballet concert because I was a male. And I had to go through the Equal Opportunity and our Sex Discrimination Commissioner and threaten a suit to be able to do it. And their whole thing was, and I worked as a swim teacher for millions of years, so I've got my what's called working with children check here. So I'm licensed and permitted to work with other people's children in a coaching role, and I've got mandatory reporting for signs of child abuse for other people's children, all of those things that I have to fulfill to have that check. Now, three-year-old ballet concert was fine. No one said anything. At the four-year-old concert, I got a letter saying, well, we can't have any males in the backstage area because it's a child protection issue. So we had a meeting. They said, well, you've got to realise that a lot of little girls backstage getting changed, they're four-year-olds, might be uncomfortable with a man being backstage. And there were two boys in the concert, and that's why I said, well, hang on, what about the two little boys being uncomfortable with women being backstage? And they said, well, no, that's different. And I said, well, you need to explain to me why. And then it came up. All of the other mums jumped on the bandwagon, supported me. They said, well, if Michael's not allowed backstage with his daughter, then we're not participating in the concert. Because, again, I'd become an honorary mum, or, you know, one of the girls to speak. Because, again, I was always the only bloke there because it was during working hours. And it made me think that the casual nature of which we impugn or, you know, predict somebody's character just on their gender, to actually say we're worried that you might be a predator, it's fine for a male. And, you know, I'm not trying to draw a false equivalency or something like that, but it's the same as when we prejudge certain religions or races or anything, any of the isms, ageisms, all of the rest of it. But for some reason, men do it. And I even had some friends that would say, oh, you can sort of understand where they're coming from. And I said, no, I can't at all, because if it's a child protection issue, what you're saying is every child there will be with a parent to protect them except for my daughter. So how is that a child protection issue? Who's going to look after my daughter? The school's response was, well, we were. And I said, yeah, but you can't have my daughter now, who's got the rest of her life because of our family situation, going to look around and go with a parent, with a parent, with a parent, and here I am on my own, through no fault of her own, through nothing to make her feel different. And that's what I said. This isn't about my rights or men's rights or dad's rights. This is about my daughter. And at that stage, we were just going through our marriage equality debate, where we were fighting for the right for marriage equality. And I said, soon you're going to have two mums, two dads, you know, and you're meant to be the contemporary bastion of liberal thinking in the arts. And here you want to slap an arbitrary ban on a bloke who's going to be next to his daughter, not taking pictures of other kids, not left to his own device, not wandering around, but helping his daughter prepare and share her nerves and karma and, you know, share in the excitement. And you're trying to take that away based solely on my gender. Do you realise what impact this will have on women? And they said, well, does she have an auntie or an aunt? She's got all of those, but I'm her parent. I'm no different to any of the other parents here. We're all parents that we're looking after our children. So you need to do better. And that's what got me into the advocacy, and that's what opened my eyes. And it went worldwide. We're on London, like every major network, and, you know, it was dad's back in the swing. But then things sort of slowly go back to normal, and, you know, you're still othered as a male in mothers' groups and some of the school situations. And there's that feeling of awkwardness, that feeling of, gee, if I say the wrong thing, I'm going to be misjudged. My daughter loves a play date, but a lot of the times the response will be when I'll speak to one of her friends' mums, you know, tell her I'd love a play date. Well, it'll be, well, I'll see what so-and-so's dad is doing and when he's available. So, again, it's that little bit exclusionary, where dads are excluded a little bit rather than welcomed in. And it's really opened my eyes to the diversity and inclusion, because what I always say now is the things that go without saying, you think, actually need to be said. So as organisations, we need to look around and we need to see who's not being not only included, but who's not participating, and drag them in, as long as they're not, you know, a terribly shy introvert that wants no part of it. They've got to be comfortable with it. But, you know, diversity of thought, experience and perspectives is what gives organisations their edges, because we can't consider the stuff that we don't even acknowledge or know about.
Thank you for sharing the story. And again, there is so much I would like to unpack there. But before I go there, I want to sort of take a bit of a step back to what when we talked about language. And also you mentioned quite a few things around mental load and part-time. And I want to unpack that in a little bit more detail and then come back to this. So another thing that the society and organizations and institutions perpetuate, and how they perpetuate this divide, is through the language we use, you know. And you already mentioned, for instance, the mental load that is probably always associated with females and mums. However, what this narrative excludes is what you exactly talked about, is the same sex marriages, is the single fathers. You know, another typical one is framing flexible working as a female or mum thing. And again, you know, you talked about it, you know, data. Of course, the data doesn't lie. Women still do more care and responsibilities. But until we talk about it being a man thing too, we are doomed to pigeonhole genders in cages called the carers and the breadwinners. You know, and another one, for instance, is a lot of the clubs, and you mentioned a couple of those as well. And so a lot of these clubs and societies are called mums and bubs, or the mummy club, and similar. Where are the dads? You know, these institutions will have the best intentions. However, they are still perpetuating this old way of thinking and excluding dad from these clubs. And now during, you know, COVID-19, excluding dads from the scans, the delivery rooms. You know, There are very few scan rooms where there is a seat for the dad. And that sends a very clear message saying, it's nice you're here, but you're not our focus. And all this makes dads feel like the third wheel in their own families. You know, it is the language we use that is so ingrained in us. And the mum is the parent and the dad is the dad. You know, he comes and goes. And that way system does not allow dads to fully participate in parenting. But what if the mom is not in the picture anymore for whatever reason? It could be the day she decided to go away, or she maybe passed away in the labor. You know, how isolating is it for the father where he quite literally feels excluded by these institutions? What are your views on sort of the language sort of specific?
Maybe you're just words out of my mouth and singing from the same hymn book as I do. Here in Australia, where I'm from, the state of Victoria, the first point of contact for new parents is called the Maternal and Child Health Centre. So, you know, and again, exactly as you said, I've never been made to feel more like a third wheel at these appointments than there. And with as much as 1 in 10 men suffering perinatal depression, it's a massive missed opportunity for screening men. It straight away, again, elevates mum into the primary role, and, you know, dad's not included. So I understand 100% that mum has to recover from the birth, and there has to be specific focus on her, but dads have specific focuses, needs, worries, concerns, and need to be dragged in. Again, as I said, they're on the outskirts, no different to somebody not participating in a meeting. We need to drag them in. And there needs to be specific focus to them. A lot of these scans happen, and the post-birth scans, you can't really get an after-hours appointment readily. So straight away, dad's excluded. The same with a lot of our mental health appointments and things like that. Outside of work, our appointments just don't exist. And yet there's a massive need for them, because if a man's not prepared to let his partner know that he's struggling, what are the chances of him asking the boss for a couple of hours off to go and see a mental health provider? But when we go back into the Maternal and Child Health Centre, dad needs to be advised on his role, because a less than optimal dad who's struggling with the whole thing, who's fearful, who feels like he should just be the assistant and defer, he's not going to do it. When I coach children, give me the child who lacks the least confidence, has the least confidence, and I'll drag him in and give him a leadership role. Straight away, his confidence goes through the roof. And that's what has to happen with dad. He needs to be told how important he is, how vital he is for language development and risk taking, and, you know, lowering anxiety and all of the benefits he needs to bring to it, rather than just being the second adult in the room. We don't even have change tables in men's toilets here. So we have them in women's toilets and we have parents' rooms, but we don't have them in men's toilets. So straight away we're saying, and this is at parks. And when I go to parks, I notice parks, swimming pools, sort of recreational or leisure physical type play areas, a lot of the times it's dads there with their kids. They've taken them out. To not have change tables in the men's toilets when there are in the women's toilets plus the parents' room, sort of sets up that, well, you know, changing nappies is really a mum's job. The number of men that I speak to who are challenged or even abused for using a parent's room because somebody might be breastfeeding or they're uncomfortable, it's staggering. It's such a common experience, and it's happened to me. But again, as a man, you still have that, you know, awkward feeling that eyes are upon you. And again, this is one of those things we've just got to go, well, hang on, is this thought justified? Is it real? Do I need to act on it, or should I just dismiss it as a silly stigma? And, you know, but you can't help, after a lifetime of conditioning, to have those feelings of awkwardness.
No, you're absolutely right. And you know, I guess what we're saying here is twofold. You know, first of all, the concept of family unit needs redesigning. And secondly, we need more dad models in the society and companies. And I want to unpack these two topics with you a little. So first of all, you know, the first thing around redesigning the concept of a family unit. Kevin Schaffer, he is a PhD in sociology and predominantly focuses his studies on fatherhood. In 2017, he did research and wrote an article about the fact that fathers tell repeatedly that they want to be more involved in family life, but are often held back by the society and the public policy to become fathers that they need to be. And that hurts moms, dads, children, and institutions alike. And in a recent interview, he admitted that it's been 4 years since he wrote that, and actually not much has changed since he wrote it. And another profound thing that Kevin Schaffer said in an interview, he said, we tie motherhood and being a woman together in ways that we do not tie fatherhood to being a man. You know, we socialize women to be mums from a very young age, yet we do not socialize our boys in the same way. Even simple things like getting boys comfortable with their emotions. And to stop this cycle, we need schools, doctors, workplaces, everyone to admit the significance of fathers and play their part in making those changes. You know, of course, we need to educate dads more on being that role model to his children. And that is a challenge in its own, because this means creating something that we often have never seen ourselves. And again, you know, you're a perfect example where you talked about the way about your upbringing, but actually where the life has taken you. And so this cycle begins, you know, much, much earlier. It doesn't begin at a moment when a man becomes a father. It becomes much earlier, as you said, you know, it becomes of how we talk to our children. You know, are the products on shop shelves, are they gender specific? Are the activities gender specific? Are job roles in professional world, are they gender specific? You know, so this cycle begins much, much, much earlier. You know, like I said, we groom girls all their lives about being mothers, and yet we don't do the same with boys. And, you know, if we had similar talks to boys for, you know, 25 years or 30 years straight, I'm sure the situation would be much different in both society and workplaces. What do you think?
Oh, 100%, baby. The men hit barriers to being an involved and present father from all different directions, from the media depictions of dad as the bumbling, you know, man-child, to advertising and marketing, to workplaces, and even the, you know, phenomenon of maternal gatekeeping. And it's not exclusive to women. You know, women find great agency and satisfaction and, you know, meaning in parenting, but so do dads. But for some reason, dads want to support mum to be a that's their version of being a good dad, is playing a support role. And I understand the feeling of feeling marginalized when bub calls out for dad instead of mum, because, you know, it was just my daughter and myself for 5 years. I've made a point of staying single because a mum left suddenly out of her life. I couldn't take the risk of someone else coming in and getting out, and plus two, I just wanted to focus on my time with my daughter. But I've got the most amazing partner now, and we spend weekends together. And when my daughter calls out for her instead of me on the weekends, it's a little bit of a twinge, I've got to admit. It's like, really? I've been relegated to sort of a dirty sock status, you know, and not the be all and end all. So, you know, it's not something that's unique to mums, but all of these things gets in the way. But, you know, the data is clear. Dads offer unique and important benefits to children, everything from language development to academic outcomes to risk-taking, you know, less anxious, just things that are specific to them. But I also like to say, because a lot of the times when I'll do a talk, I'll have mums come up and say, oh, but I don't have a man in my child's life, you know, is this going to go wrong? And that's why I say, don't think that I'm assigning the benefits to the gender. I'm assigning the benefits to the behavior. So risk taking and roughhousing and using proper adult formed languages. Mums help children form language with the way they speak, but dads are more likely to use full sentences and not use the baby talk. So it stretches bubs. But together, the two of them work beautifully. And that's what I say to dads who are single and they doubt themselves as far as being able to raise and nurture a child. And I've gone, well, you can. It's not, I really have a problem with the way we assign certain traits and behaviours to certain genders, even in leadership and organisations. When we say, you know, Jacinda Ardern, for example, she gets a lot of plaudits for being a great female leader. Well, she's a great leader, not because of a gender, not despite a gender, but because of her talent and application. The reason why I think that there are some such stellar examples of great leaders who happen to be female is because of the hurdles and the obstacles that they face along the way. It's like an athlete being match ready, having a hard season and turning up at the finals, fit, ready, conditioned, ready for the match. And I think, you know, a lot of men do rise through the ranks through who they know and connections, and just they do have it a little bit easier. But when the heat's on, when they're under pressure, their lack of skills to get there show up. So again, you know, when they say female leaders are great because they're empathetic, well, no, great leaders are great leaders because they're empathetic. Please don't assign good or bad traits to either gender. It's the same with the fad now of assigning everything to toxic masculinity. Well, whether I'm gay, straight, transgender, if I'm a male or identify as a male, anything I do is masculine. So, you know, stop putting it into traits. There's bad behavior. If somebody behaves badly, the problem is with their character and values, not with their gender.
I totally agree with that. And of course, you know, we need to celebrate the great leaders. And, you know, and obviously when we talk about these leaders and we say empathetic, obviously most of them are females, but absolutely, you know, these traits are universal. They're not gender specific. And that, I guess, alludes me to the second part of the same question around needing more dad role models in society and companies, and not just at the top, because the perception is that these dads can afford such lifestyles. You know, we need more leaders and dads at a lower level. We need more dads not being afraid of being vulnerable, you know, telling that you're sad or you're tired. You know, it's important to normalize these feelings in men. Instead, you know, there is this load and pressure on dads being the breadwinners and making enough money to provide for their families. And if they're not doing that, or not doing that to some sort of unwritten standard, they are failing as fathers. That is their job. But by working their butts off for their children and families, dads miss out on this precious time with their children. And all children want is their presence. So there is... There's a stat that I heard recently that 75% of time you spend with your children is before the age of 16. So yep. By perpetuating this taboo of dads being the financial providers, that they have to be seen working their butts off, if not being normal for them, it's not being normal for them to pick up their children from school or take a day off to be with their sick children at home, just creates this real lose-lose situation where fathers are missing out on this precious time with their kids, which makes them upset, guilty, unhappy. And an unhappy person won't be optimal at and their most effective and productive at work either. So obviously, we already talked about the fact that there's a lot that organizations, both government and workplaces, need to do to show more of these role models and normalize the role of a father, and not just as a dad, but equal parent. So perhaps, do you have any sort of practical steps for organizations that organizations can take to ensure a better allyship for both mums and dads?
Yeah, definitely. One of the things, a frightening statistic, is men are more likely to lie about their health than to admit that they're attending to family responsibilities. So more likely to take a day off citing that they're sick or they're ill or they have a doctor's appointment than admitting that they've got to do a school concert or anything like that. The number of men that I speak to who are up in the top levels of organisations that will leave their jacket on the back of the chair and sneak out, do the school run and come back in and work late rather than admit that they were ducking out to attend to family issues is staggering. So that's what I say in the organisation, dads, you need to leave loud and leave proud. And, you know, children should never be seen as the interruption to our careers because they're the very purpose for it. The reason our jobs are important and our careers are important is because we want to provide for our family. So there's a lot of people in the advocacy bubble that say, well, there's a motherhood penalty and a fatherhood bonus because dads, when they become dads, will increase their earnings. Well, you know, they increase their earnings, but they decrease their time with their children. And the reason that they do that is because they're locked into the outdated gender expectations where being a dad is being a good provider. There's some really interesting stats that show that apart from the 20% of children that live in poverty, there's no linear benefit to increase in income in the family. So apart from slightly higher academic achievement for higher income families, but they also have a lower dropout rate in university. And I'm not sure why that is, but anecdotally, you would think that, they're fairly secure in their future if they've come from wealth and privilege. Whereas if they're not, they might value what their education could achieve for them in the future. So there's so much data around that says that time with your children, better social, psychological, physical, behavioural outcomes are associated with better connection and time with your parents. So as I say to dads, you know, if you think that the version of being the best dad is working yourself to death to provide money for stuff that you don't really need and it's taking you away from your child, you would have better outcomes for your child if you lessened your workload and spent more time with your child. If that's your motivation, if that's a story load, said, you know, it's great to get satisfaction and identity and fulfillment from your job. But if you're telling yourself, well, I'm doing it for my children's benefit or my family benefit, then you need to find another story or look at the data around it.
But obviously, we've got another huge era right now that we are going through that is also changing the way we work and live. And that's obviously this pandemic. So how has this pandemic played out in family lives and parenting? You know, dads often get together and talk about parenting topics as a side chat at a pub while watching a football. And these are spaces people in many countries currently do not have access to. So how have you seen the pandemic affecting these conversations and parenthood in general? And what are the safe spaces now the fathers can access to talk and get support on these topics?
It's been great for me personally, and you know, I'm not trying to diminish or downplay the effect of the pandemic. For me, it's actually been quite good, but I had not, through any great foresight or divine intervention, I had my life in order as a solo parent. I had to simplify and downgrade and not take on too much. After being ill and worrying about my future with my daughter, I've made my decision. My values are 100% with my daughter. And I don't think the pandemic actually changed a whole lot. It just exposed and exacerbated the faulty system that we worked under. You know, there are some dads that are spending 2 hours a day commuting to work. All of a sudden, they had that time with their family. At the moment, there's a couple of surveys out here in Australia that show that 75% of fathers are actively considering changing their job should things go back to maintain the level of family connectedness and time that they had during the pandemic. So it really showed up the flaws and our fine weather thinking that we had, whereas if I leverage myself and I extend myself financially and I borrow this money and I put off things like my health and my connection with my children to a day in the future, gee, you know, this stuff would happen. It also showed the fragility, the house of cards that we had built things on, and, you know, the whole economy versus health debate that went on around the world. It's not an either or, but the reason why women were so heavily impacted is because they were already on the edge, and the reason that they wore so much stress with the homeschooling and all of the other things is because they could manage it while things were sort of running themselves and things were going along smoothly. Suddenly, when everything got heaped on top of itself, it just showed, it was like a giant stress test on a bridge where we load all this extra weight on and see where the cracks are. And there's the cracks. It's because women were doing the majority of the stuff at home, and they weren't doing it necessarily because they should or they could or they wanted to. It's just we'd sleepwalked into a system, and we'd supported it with a lot of our equality initiatives by supporting women inside the workplace to be able to do it. And then all of a sudden, dads now have a real appreciation for what they've done. But dads also have a real desire to continue this. So I know so many fathers that say, you know what, it's been a good time. But we also showed that organisations can initiate flexible working when they want to. So that's why I say your situation and circumstances are the constraints in which innovation thrives. So with me, my original work before my daughter and when her mum was still on the scene, I would work 80 hours, travel all the time with sporting teams, do all this stuff. Suddenly, bang, that's no longer feasible. What could I do? Well, I handpicked my best clients, put them together into groups, and now I manage to work a few hours each week just with specific clients. Because I had an abundance of time and there were no real constraints on it, I was not efficient. I was earning well, but it was spread over so many hours. Now I earn a lot higher sort of hourly rate, and I work less hours and I'm able to maintain my family thing. So every now and again, I'll get offered a job, but it will mean, you know, 10 days or 14 days away at a tournament or a job interstate speaking to organizations. Unless I can take my daughter with me, I'd turn it down. But other things turn up because having a set of core values for organizations or individuals, it'll simplifies life. It shows you what to ignore, what doesn't matter, what's background noise, and what fits within your wheelhouse. And you become laser focused and go, great, that's me, I'll do that. And those opportunities fill up.
Michael, thank you so much for all of the expertise that you've shared with me today. We've really had a rich conversation. We've covered a lot of ground from the language, the stereotypes, organization, institution, and you've had some absolutely fantastic, very personal stories that you've shared to bring this topic to life. And in a very, very, you know, inspiring conversation, I do hope that this conversation inspires both parents and institutions alike to be better and do better. So thank you, Michael, so much for being with me and covering this topic with me today.
Thanks so much, baby. I really enjoyed the chat.
This pandemic has come at a too high of a cost for us to take for granted. And so we have to take the short window of opportunity we've been given to address these inclusion discrepancies. And parents are a huge part of it. And so I have a great hope for 2021 that we will reflect on our lifestyles and on our roles as parents, professionals, and citizens of our communities. What do our routines have to look like when we eventually come out of these lockdowns and isolation? This is a time to rethink your family unit and blur the lines between the gender roles in your household so you can all come together as one whole unit and help and support each other. This also means respecting each other's personal space and shielding that me time that we are not getting often enough. And building empathy is a critical ingredient for this. I hope this podcast episode has given you plenty to think about and reflect on as a parent. Or if you're not a parent, as a professional, when you rethink your policy or plan for your next inclusion initiative. Because remember, inclusion work is not just about including the protected characteristics. It is about everyone. Your mums, dads, single parents, same-sex marriages and so on. No one should be left behind. Please rate and review this podcast and join me in for conversation using hashtag ChangeAgentPodcast on Twitter. Michael's details are in show notes, so please connect with him and get engaged with his work. My details are also below for you to talk to me about how I can help your organization with building cultural intelligence and literacy on diversity, equity, and inclusion topics. In the meantime, I'll allow you to reflect on the material covered today, and we'll be looking forward for you joining me again next Friday. But for now, stay safe. And until next time.